ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
This is Bertrand L. Comperay, and I have a few things in my mind about which I'd like to talk to you. The first of these is the fact that contrary to what is taught in most churches, Noah's flood was not worldwide. Among the many mistaken and unscriptural notions commonly taught in nearly all churches is the idea that the flood mentioned in the Bible covered all the earth and drowned everybody on earth excepting only Noah and his family, who escaped death by being in the ark. So many churches have firmly insisted that the Bible says this, when there is ample proof that the flood was not worldwide, that they have destroyed the faith of multitudes of people in the Bible, made atheists or agnostics out of hundreds of thousands of people who might have become Christians if they had only been taught the truth about the Bible. Part of this mistaken idea about the flood is due to the many mistranslations found in the commonly used King James Version of the Bible. But also, part of it appears plainly to be false if you merely carefully read even the King James Version. Let's have a look at this. In Genesis chapter 6, we read that God found the people so corrupt that he regretted that he had ever created them, and so he decided to wipe them out by a flood. And he warned righteous Noah of the coming flood, and told Noah to build a great boat or ark in which he and his family might find safety, and where they might preserve a few of each kind of the animals. In chapter 7, it tells how Noah received the final warning that the time was now at hand, and that he should move into the ark. Then it says, according to the King James Version, "And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the 2nd month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. And the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And the waters prevailed, and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went upon the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast, and of every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth, and every man. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. And God remembered Noah and every living thing, and all the cattle that was with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters assuaged. And the waters returned from off the earth continually. And after the end of the 150 days, the waters were abated. And the ark rested in the 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the 1st day of the month, were the tops of the mountains seen." Now, first let's see what the translators have done to what Moses originally wrote. You remember that the King James Version says that the rain was upon the earth, and the waters increased greatly upon the earth, and that all flesh died that moved upon the earth. But are they right in translating this, the earth? Definitely not. Remember that in Genesis 4:14, when God has driven Cain away in punishment for his murder of Abel, the King James Version quotes Cain as saying, "Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth." So what did Cain do? Climb into his rocket ship and take off for outer space? Of course not. He was not driven from the face of the earth, and he never said so. Only the translators said so. The word Cain used was Adamah, meaning the ground. God had told him that his farming would no longer be successful. So Cain says, "Thou hast driven me off of the ground." And you have probably noticed that Cain's descendants today are not farmers. They run pawn shops and other money-lending institutions. When we come to the 7th chapter of Genesis, where it is talking about the flood, wherever it says that the flood covered the earth, the Hebrew word used in the original writing by Moses was Eretz, meaning the land. The flood did cover that particular land where it occurred. That is, it was a local flood which covered one particular region or land, but not the whole earth. Again, notice that it specifies that 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. In ancient times, two different lengths of the cubit were in use. The Hebrew sacred cubit of 25 inches and the common cubit of 20 5/8 inches. Therefore, the waters rose above the tops of the mountains of which it is speaking by either 25 feet 9 inches or 31 feet 3 inches, according to which cubit you use. If this meant that all the mountains on earth were covered, the waters would have to cover Mount Everest, which is nearly 6 miles high. Therefore, all the earth would be covered by water 6 miles deep. In that case, where could it have run off to when the flood subsided? No, I don't mean that the Bible was that badly mistaken. Only the translators made this mistake, because they took a Hebrew word, Eretz, which means that land, and mistranslated it to mean the whole world. A little later, we shall look over the evidence which proves where that land was. But if the whole earth was covered by 6 miles of water, then all the nations must have been completely exterminated. Yet Babylonian, Egyptian, and Chinese history runs right through this period without a break. The Bible gives the date of Noah's flood as commencing in 2345 BC and ending in 2344 BC. In Lower Sumer, later called Chaldea, and which occupied the same plains of Shinar to which Noah's family journeyed after the flood, the city of Ur of the Chaldees was the leading city from about 2400 BC until about 2285 BC, and its history is not broken by any flood in this period. Farther to the north, Babylon was rising to power from about 2400 BC on, and reached a great height of civilization under the famous King Hammurabi, who lived at the same time as the Hebrew patriarch Abraham, about 2250 BC. And again, there is no break in this history due to a flood. In Egypt, the 11th dynasty began to reign about 2375 BC over a great and powerful nation. The 11th dynasty ruled Egypt to about 2212 BC, and were followed by the 12th dynasty, which ruled to about 2000 BC. There was no break in the 11th dynasty at the time of Noah's flood, 2345 BC, and the nation continued to be large and powerful throughout this period. Reasonably accurate history of China begins nearly 3000 BC. The Shu King, the historic record of China, shows that King Yao came to the throne in 2356 BC, 11 years before the start of Noah's flood, and that he ruled China for many years after the flood. During the reign of King Yao, the Shu King reports that the Huanghe River, which drains mountains and a great basin in Xinjiang province, had excessive floods for 3 generations. Here again, there was no break in history. The Chinese nation was not wiped out, but its own records show that it continued in existence right through the period of Noah's flood. Therefore, the Bible is correct in stating that the flood covered only Eretz, that land, and that the translators are wrong when they change the meaning of what Moses really wrote in the 7th chapter of Genesis and say that the flood covered all the earth. This leaves us ready to inquire where the flood did occur. For this, we will have to start with Adam and Eve and trace where they and their descendants went. They started out in the Garden of Eden. Genesis 2, verses 10 to 14 tells us that a river went out of Eden, and this river divided into four streams. It names these four rivers, Pison and Gihon, neither of which can be identified among the rivers existing today, and Hiddekel, which is the ancient name of the Tigris River, and Frath, the ancient name of the river Euphrates. The Tigris and Euphrates rise in what is today extreme southeastern Turkey, a little north of modern Iraq. Making some allowance for the fact that many rivers have changed their courses considerably in the course of several thousand years, this still places the Garden of Eden at the northern end of ancient Akkad. When Adam and Eve were driven out of the Garden of Eden, Genesis 3, verse 24 tells us that God placed cherubim with a flaming sword at the east side of the Garden of Eden to keep Adam and Eve from returning and having access to the tree of life. If this guard was to accomplish anything, it must have been placed between Adam and the Garden of Eden. So we see that Adam and Eve were driven out to the eastward. From Eden, Adam's course would naturally have led him across northern Iran, around the southern end of the Caspian Sea, into what was formerly called Chinese Turkestan, and today is known as Xinjiang Province, in the extreme west of China. In the southern part of Xinjiang, there is a great basin rimmed by high mountains on all sides, but with an outlet on the eastern end of it, through the mountains where the headwaters of the Huang Ho, the Yellow River, rises. This basin is today nearly all desert, but it bears the evidence of a fertile and heavily inhabited past. Explorers have found ruins of ancient cities uncovered by the drifting sands of the desert. Also, the known geological structure shows that in ancient times, at least, beneath this desert lay an enormous underground natural reservoir, great caverns filled with water. The same geological structure which furnishes artesian water in many parts of the world today. These underground reservoirs were covered by waterproof layers of rock, which kept the waters beneath from overflowing out on the land surface above them. In this mountain-rimmed basin, which was then a fertile, well-populated land, Adam and Eve, or at least their descendants of a few generations later, settled. You who listen to our program already know that Adam was not the first man. He was only the first man in the present white race. Adam and Eve found this land to which they had come already populated by an Asiatic people, among whom they had to live. Through the following generations, the inevitable happened. Wherever there is integration, then intermarriage and mongrelization of the races follows. But if God had no purposes in mind which could not be properly served by the Asiatic and Negro races, there would have been no reason for him to create Adam. Neither could the purposes which Adam and his descendants were intended to serve be fulfilled by a mongrelized race. The consequences of this mongrelization are described in Genesis 6, verse 5. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Again, we find that the word there mistranslated earth is the Hebrew word eretz, which means only the land, that particular land. And there is reason for using that Hebrew word, for this was the place where integration and mongrelization had taken place, with its degenerative effects, as compared to the qualities possessed by each race separately. We find confirmation of this in the reason why God spared Noah. In Genesis 6, verse 9, your King James Version of the Bible tells you that Noah was perfect in his generations, a meaningless phrase. When anything in the King James Version of the Bible fails to make good sense, it is a sign that you should go behind the mistranslation and see what the words were in the original Hebrew or Greek. The word here translated generations was the Hebrew word toledo, which means ancestry. That is, Noah was perfect in his ancestry, a thoroughbred, not a mongrel. Noah and his family were the last remaining pure-blooded Adamites in the world. Therefore, God needed to save them to carry out the purposes he had planned for the Adamic people. The mongrelized people among whom Noah and his family lived must be removed, else they would be a trap which would eventually lead to the complete end of the pure-blooded Adamites. Have we any other evidence to support our view that this was the region where Adam and Eve and their descendants settled? Yes. Remember that Adam and Eve were driven out of Eden to the eastward. Later, when Cain murdered Abel, and as the punishment was banished from the land where Adam and Eve lived, Genesis 4 verse 16 tells us that Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. The Hebrew word Nod means wandering. That is, in the upper Tigris and Euphrates valleys at the north of Eden, these rivers were running swiftly downhill from their mountain sources. Therefore, they cut themselves deep channels in the ground, and even today we can find the traces of the ancient diversion dams built by the ancients to raise the water level up close to the surface of the ground so they would not have to pump it so high to get it into their irrigation canals. But further to the south, in the lower Tigris and Euphrates valleys, where the slope was no longer steep, the accumulation of silt picked up of the rivers where they ran swiftly was now settling to the bottom of the riverbeds, constantly raising the level, so that every high water season the rivers overflowed their banks and flooded the valleys, exactly the same as we have had in our own Mississippi Valley. These annual floods washed away the people's houses and sent them fleeing far away to high ground. Therefore, it was correctly called the land of Nod, the land of wandering. Here Cain settled and taught the people to build high dikes along the river banks, just as we have done along the banks of the Mississippi River. This enabled them to stop the annual floods, so they could now build permanent cities of good houses in the lower Tigris and Euphrates valleys, the land then called by its own inhabitants Sumer, and later called Chaldea. In a very few places, the Bible calls it the Plain of Shinar. That is, Cain went back westward from where Adam and Eve lived. It was thus that Cain started his great empire. Yes, Cain is a well-known historical character, not found only in the Bible, but he is known in history under another name. He established an empire which extended from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean Sea, and even took in some of the larger islands in the Mediterranean Sea. Another bit of evidence is found in Genesis 11, verse 2, which tells us that after the flood, Noah's descendants journeyed from the east until they came to the land of Shinar. Therefore, they must have come from some place east of the Tigris and Euphrates valleys. And the only place where such a flood as the Bible describes could have occurred, eastward from the Tigris and Euphrates valleys, is this mountain basin in Sinkiang, which I have been talking about. Another bit of evidence is found in the high water mark found in many places along the mountains which rim this basin, showing that at one time this basin was a lake extending to this well-marked shoreline. The mountains which rim this valley were not fully covered, for many of them range from 16,000 to 25,000 feet in height, and one even rises more than 28,000 feet. But within the basin are several smaller mountains which could be fully covered by a flood held within the higher rim of the valley. In short, this basin, through which flows the Tarim River, and which is sometimes known as the Tarim Basin in southern Sinkiang, is identified as the site of Noah's flood. In your King James Version, Genesis 7, verses 11 and 12 read, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were open, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. More careful translation makes clear what really happened. In Moffat's Modern English Translation we read, The fountains of the great abyss all burst, and the sluices of heaven were opened. In Smith and Goodspeed's American translation, it says, "The fountains of the great abyss were all broken open, and the windows of the heavens were opened." That is, a great earthquake broke up the waterproof layer of rock over the immense water-filled abyss or cavern beneath this Tarim Basin, causing the floor of the valley to settle, and allowed an enormous underground reservoir to overflow and to submerge the valley floor. Of course, the 40 days of torrential rains added to the flood. This filled the valley high enough to submerge the low mountains which were inside the valley. This is exactly as Genesis 7, verses 19 to 20 says. Don't be misled by the mistranslation, "All the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered." The word mistranslated heaven is merely the Hebrew word shamah, meaning the sky. Since this Tarim Basin is somewhat more than 350 miles wide by more than 650 miles long, all the sky visible from anywhere near the center of this valley would cover only this valley, and therefore only those lower mountains which were within the valley itself. But what about Genesis 8, verse 4, reading, "And the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat"? Sometimes failure to translate can be just as misleading as outright mistranslation. Most people understand this to mean Mount Ararat in Armenia, some 1,600 miles west of the Tarim Basin. But this is not what the Bible says. First of all, note that it says mountains of Ararat, mountains being in the plural, while Mount Ararat in Armenia is only a single peak. But Mount Ararat in Armenia was known until comparatively recent times as Mount Massus, and nobody had ever heard of it being called Mount Ararat in Bible times. Furthermore, the Hebrew word Ararat means only the tops of the hills. Therefore, correctly translated, Genesis 8 verse 4 merely says that the ark came to rest upon the tops of the high hills, some of the lower mountains which were within the Tarim Valley. A recent newspaper report mentions an expedition equipped with the latest electronic equipment which is going to Mount Ararat in Armenia to find the ark, and which will melt the ice which covers the ark by coating it with black powdered carbon. But they won't find Noah's ark, for it is not there. Several expeditions have gone to this Mount Ararat to find the ark, and some of them got within sight of a mast on the side of a mountain, which, from that particular point of view, looked to be shaped somewhat like a ship. That point has been very carefully inspected from the air by airplanes flying over it very close, and it has proved to be nothing but a ledge of rock, which does give a silhouette shaped like a ship when seen from the right direction. So when we carefully examine the whole affair and correct the mistranslations, we find there is no conflict between what the Bible really says and either science or history. In fact, there never is any such conflict. It is only the preachers who find themselves contradicted by either science or history. And that is only because they either won't take the trouble to find out what the Bible really says, or because they have made the mistranslation a supposedly sacred church doctrine, and now they are stuck with it. Don't let any church shake your faith in the Bible. The Bible is always right, even if the churches are often wrong. Let us remember another thing. The ancient Chinese historical record, the Shu King, records that during the reign of King Yao, at a time beginning about the date of Noah's flood, the Huang Ho carried excessive floods for three generations. Drainage out of the Tarim Basin to the eastward would have been carried off in the Huang Ho River and would account for this. Now we come to another false doctrine taught in many churches, that since nobody survived in all the earth except Noah and his family, everybody now living is a descendant of Noah and related by blood, no matter what race they belong to. But we have already seen that the flood did not cover the whole earth, but only one valley, about 350 by 650 miles in size. The Chinese history was not interrupted by it, although they do record purely local floods in the Huang Ho Valley, where the waters were draining off. We have seen that Egyptian history is not interrupted by the flood, so the continent of Africa was not touched by it, and the Negro race continued unaffected by it. It would be absurd to think that Noah and his wife, both of them being white, could have one white child, one Negro child, and one Chinese child. Remember that in Genesis 1, verses 11 to 25, when God created the world and its inhabitants and made the laws governing their reproduction, he did not make it absurd chaos with whales giving birth to cattle and fish hatching out of birds' eggs. His law, repeated several times for emphasis, is always that each creature must bring forth strictly after his own kind. The churches which teach this false doctrine of everybody being descended from Noah never got it out of the Bible, that is, in any true translation of the Bible. As Moses wrote it in the Hebrew language, under divine inspiration, the Bible correctly tells that Noah's descendants went out into a world already populated by people who had lived right through the time of the flood and were still going strong. Ferrar Fenton's Modern English translation gives this correctly. In Genesis 10, verses 1 to 5, we read of the descendants of Noah's son Japheth, and it says, "From these they spread themselves over the sea coasts of the countries of the nations, each with their own language amongst the Gentile tribes." Genesis 10, verse 20 tells of the descendants of Noah's son Ham. "These were the sons of Ham in their tribes and languages in the regions of the heathen." Genesis 10, verse 31 completes it. "These are the sons of Shem, by their tribes and by their languages, in their countries among the heathen." So never let anybody tell you that the Bible consists of the fables of a primitive people. It is perfectly consistent with all true science and all true history. It is the history of our race, the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Teutonic white race. The Bible is scientific. So often we hear someone make the foolish statement that modern science has disproved the Bible, or disproved some part of it. Nothing can be further from the truth. There is no conflict between a correct translation of the Bible and that which is true science. Remember that many theories have been put forth as science and have been believed by many people, only to be proven false by more careful study a few years later. I will admit that there's a great conflict between what many ministers preach and what we know to be true science, but there's an even greater conflict between what these preachers say and what is really in the Bible. The Bible has its own purpose, and it sticks to that purpose. It does not purport to be a manual of instructions for the use and repair of an IBM computer, nor a textbook from which to teach schoolboys their mathematics. Its purpose is so much greater than any of these that it has no time to waste on them. Aside from the various laws governing agriculture, diet, economics, and so forth, the Bible's principal purpose in going into scientific matters is to prove the divine inspiration of the book by stating scientific matters which were not known by the best scientists of the day in which it was written, and which therefore could not be a display of merely human wisdom and knowledge. Let's look at some examples of science in the Bible. We all know that even when Columbus made his voyage to the Western Hemisphere in the year 1492 AD, it was not generally known that the earth was round. He faced the threat of mutiny from his crew out of fear that he would sail too close to the edge of the flat earth and the ship would be swept over the edge to fall down into no man knew what. In fact, all who believed that the earth was round, and they were very few in number, were regarded as heretics. Today we know that the earth is almost exactly spherical in shape, and when seen from any direction, its outline is a circle. But God declared that fact to the prophet Isaiah in the year 712 B.C. It is found in Isaiah 40, verses 21 and 22. Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is He that sits upon the circle of the earth. Until the days of Galileo and Newton, when modern gravitational science was born, it was not known that the earth could float free in space. People saw that everything fell down until it came to rest upon the earth itself, and if you picked up a rock or a handful of soil and dropped that, that too would fall down. Obviously, therefore, the entire earth itself must have the same tendency to fall down unless it was resting upon something strong enough to support the earth. That's how their wisest men reasoned and believed. They couldn't agree as to what it was that supported the earth. The Hindus, who have always prided themselves on being such a wise and spiritual race, were firmly convinced that the earth rested upon the backs of four elephants, and the elephant stood upon the back of a giant turtle. Neither their spirituality nor their wisdom were great enough to discover what it was that supported the turtle. Even the highly cultured and intelligent Greeks believed that the earth rested upon the shoulders of the giant Atlas, and they likewise could not find out what it was that Atlas stood upon. But in the book of Job, chapter 26, verse 8, we are told that He hangs the earth upon nothing. That is, the earth being supported by nothing floated free in space. When we consider that the Job of this book is very probably the Jobab, that is, Father Job, of Genesis 10, verse 29, which would put the date of this scientific truth that the earth floated free in space at least 2000 B.C., we may be certain that it was not the current knowledge of the wise men, but a revelation from God. And consider also the other remarkable statement in this same verse, Job 26, verse 8. He stretches out the north over the empty place. Only a very small fraction of the stars can be seen by the naked eye. Even the smaller telescopes revealed vast multitudes of stars which had never been seen by man before that time. The problem is not one of magnification, for smaller telescopes can be made to magnify as many times as the larger types. It is rather that a small telescope can't take in enough light to make use of high magnification. That is why the astronomers have been making larger and larger telescopes, instruments which will gather in so much light that we can see stars so far away that their light is too dim to be seen or photographed with any smaller telescope. Great telescopes have revealed multitudes of dim, far-distant stars in parts of the sky where the unaided eye finds only darkness. But even our most powerful and largest telescopes can find nothing, just a blank, completely empty place in the sky, in one spot in the north. Since no such telescopes existed in ancient times, it was divine revelation which told that God had stretched the north over the empty place. Today, we all know that the earth rotates on its axis, the north and south pole being the ends of this axis. But this knowledge is recent. In 1543 A.D., the astronomer Copernicus disputed the common belief that the earth was the stationary center of the universe, with the sun, stars, and planets revolving around the earth. This view was condemned by the Catholic Church as heresy. When Galileo, by his own studies and experiments, reached the same conclusion, he was tried for his life before the Inquisition in Rome, and he only escaped death by making a public recantation of this view. Nevertheless, these men in the 1500s and 1600s A.D. laid the foundation for modern astronomy with the knowledge that the sun is the center of our solar system, that the earth revolves around the sun, and the apparent rise of the sun and stars in the east and their setting in the west is really due to the rotation of the earth on its axis. But God took notice of this fact in the book of Job, about 2000 B.C. In Job 38, verses 12 to 14, he asks, "Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days, and caused the day spring to know his place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth? It turns itself as clay of a seal." In other words, have you held on to the ends of the earth's axis while it turned itself? This was over 3,500 years before science discovered the fact of the earth's rotation on its axis. For countless thousands of years, men have noted the contrast between the salt water of the ocean and the fresh water which falls as rain. But it took more knowledge than they had to realize that this salt water of the ocean was the source of the fresh rainwater. Men had watched clouds in the sky since men existed, but they knew little of the nature of clouds. The ancients believed that the thunder was the noise of clouds colliding in the sky, which shows that they didn't know that clouds were only water vapor. But again, in the book of Job, chapter 36, verses 27 and 28, we find scientific truth revealed. "For he makes small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly." Not a man then alive knew that rain was distilled water from the ocean, which had lost its salt by the process of distillation. But God revealed this in advance of science. More of this is revealed in the book of Ecclesiastes. This book is generally credited to Solomon, and if so, it was written about 977 B.C. In chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, it says, "The wind goes toward the south and turns about unto the north. It whirls about continually, and the wind returns again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again." Today we know that this is true. We know that the winds do whirl about continually, rotating in huge circles in a clockwise direction in the southern hemisphere and counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere. But even as a theory, a mere conjecture, this idea is of recent origin, and proof of its accuracy is very modern. Yet 28 centuries ago, the Bible told us, first, that the winds rotate in great circles, and second, that the water of the rivers, although fresh water, actually originated in the salt water of the oceans. When these facts were announced by Galileo in the first half of the 1600s, they were not believed, and they were denounced as dangerous heresies. So if you've been under the impression that the Bible couldn't stand examination by science, or that God needed to take some science classes under some left-wing liberal professors in our modern universities, then go back and read the Bible again. You will find it very scientific. But let's look up some more of these scientific facts in the Bible. We may take notice that the fact that light moves is a relatively recent discovery. Its rate of speed was proved only within the time of men now living. But in Job 38, verse 19, God asks, "Where is the way where light dwells?" Note that, not the place, which would imply that light is stationary, but the way, the path of moving light. That the lightning, the thunderbolt, moves is no new idea, of course. But only within the last 30 years have we had such high-speed movie cameras that we could discover a new fact about lightning. That the bolt of lightning does not start out all by itself. Before the lightning bolt can strike, there is first a small pilot discharge, which seems to serve no purpose but to prepare the air for the real lightning bolt to follow by ionizing the air so it becomes a conductor of electricity. That is, there must first be something to prepare a way for the lightning, to open the path for it. This, remember, was only discovered within your own lifetime, in fact, since World War II. But in Job 38, verse 25, God asks, "Who has divided a way for the lightning of thunder?" Don't let anyone tell you that this book is only a collection of primitive superstitions. At first impression, nothing would seem sillier than the idea that the air has weight. Of course, everybody is supposed to know that fact today, but he was first discovered by Galileo in the year 1630 A.D. Yet in Job 28, verse 25, it speaks of the weight of the winds. A century ago, man discovered that electricity could be used to deliver messages at a distance, the telegraph. But God knew all about that ahead of time, for he asked Job in Job 38, verse 35, "Canst thou send lightnings that they may go and say unto thee, Here we are?" The Hebrew language had no word for electricity except lightning, so that's what Job wrote down. But electricity and lightning are the same thing, the only difference being in the amount of power involved. But let's not just stay on Earth, nor even in the solar system. Let's examine our entire galaxy, the multitude of stars which form the Milky Way. There are at least 30 billion stars in this one galaxy, which is shaped like a biconvex lens. Our own sun is one of the minor stars in this system, and its position is about two-thirds of the way out toward one edge of the galaxy. We are some 30,000 light years away from the center of the galaxy. Since one light year is about 5,870,000,000,000 miles, our distance from the center of the galaxy, being 30,000 times this much, is far more than 1 sextillion miles. In numerals, it is 1761 followed by 15 zeros. The entire galaxy, this vast lens-shaped mass of stars, rotates around its collective center of gravity, the whole galaxy making one rotation in about 200 million years. The center of gravity of the galaxy is marked by the star Alcyone, which is the brightest star in the constellation Pleiades. Now, considering that this is nearly 2 sextillion miles away from us, it was not easy to get acquainted with it, and our knowledge on the subject came within the lifetime of men still alive. Yet in Job 38, verse 31, God asks Job, "Canst thou bind the sweet influence of Pleiades?" Yes, it is a sweet influence, for it keeps us in our course instead of wandering aimlessly through space until we would collide with some other mighty solar system. It is also worth noting that the Hebrew word for Pleiades, kimo, also means pivot or hinge. I guess we'll have to admit that God is pretty much up to date after all. But if anyone is thinking that this is old-fashioned science of nature itself, and does not include man's latest inventions, such as the hydrogen bomb, let me tell you that God also knew about that. All scientists agree that all of the stars, including our sun, generate their heat by the same process used in the hydrogen bomb. That is, four atoms of hydrogen combine to form one atom of helium, releasing the surplus energy at the most fantastically high heat. The hydrogen bomb is therefore an artificial and miniature star, characterized above all else by its extreme heat. Do you think that this is modern science? Then listen to 2 Esdras 15, telling of our defense when we are attacked by the hordes of Asiatic Chinese and Russians. "The great and mighty cloud shall be lifted up, full of wrath, and the star, that they may make all the earth afraid, and them that dwell therein. And they shall pour out over every great and eminent place a horrible star. And they shall break down the cities and walls, mountains and hills, trees of the wood and grass of the meadows, and their corn. They shall come to her and besiege her. The star and all wrath shall they pour out upon her. Then shall the dust and smoke go up unto heaven, and they that be about her shall bewail her. And thou, Asia, that art partaker of the hope of Babylon, and art the glory of her person, woe be unto thee, thou wretch, because thou hast made thyself like unto her. Thou hast followed her that is hated in all her works and inventions. Therefore, thus saith God, I will send plagues upon thee, widowhood, poverty, famine, sword, and pestilence, to waste thy houses with destruction and death. And the glory of thy power shall be dried up like a flower, when the heat shall arise that is sent over thee. Note that this says that someone is going to Asia and will pour out over every great and eminent place there a horrible star. Now, the only star that anybody can carry to Asia and pour out over her important places is the artificial miniature star of the hydrogen bomb. It further adds that the power of Asia shall be dried up by the heat that is sent over it. Again, a clear reference to the hydrogen bomb, for its heat is even more destructive than its blast effect. Again, it mentions that the clouds of dust as well as smoke shall go up into heaven. No bombs of ordinary explosives have ever produced an effect that could be thus described, even by the most poetic fancy. But you remember that a characteristic of even the atom bomb, and in far greater measure in the hydrogen bomb, is the fact that the awful updraft from the fireball sweeps up a huge cloud of radioactive dust from the ground, as well as smoke from the fire started by the bomb. And this mushroom cloud of both dust and smoke has been measured as rising more than 25 miles into the sky. We have another reference to this in Isaiah 25, verses 2 to 5, which promises that to us God will be a shadow from the heat when the blast of the terrible ones is as a storm against the wall. But this same passage says that to our enemies, God will bring down the noise of strangers as the heat in a dry place, the heat with the shadow of a cloud. The only kind of cloud shadow that could bring heat is the awful shadow of the mushroom cloud of an atom bomb or hydrogen bomb. Again, Mark 13, verse 25, and Luke 21, verse 26, hold another and a hidden key. They say that the powers that are in heaven shall be shaken. Now, the word translated heaven is the Greek word Uranos, from which we derive the word uranium, the explosive of the atom bomb. And the word translated shaken also means agitated or stirred up. So there is here a strong hint that the powers that are in uranium are to be agitated or stirred up. As I said at the start, God didn't try to write a mechanic's handbook for the operation or repair of present-day machinery, nor even a school textbook for teaching science. He had in mind other purposes far too important to allow waste of time on minor matters. But he knew that men are skeptical, that they must be convinced. So he included in the Bible enough science to convince anyone who has intelligence and an open mind. Especially because most of this science was not understood by any man until practically our own times, thousands of years after it was written in the Bible. Never let anyone tell you that the Bible is old-fashioned, out of date, a book of ignorant superstitions. If you will only study it carefully, you will see that it proves itself to be the inspired Word of God, true in every one of His statements. Few of us can boast of any great prosperity in these days. Many of us find it hard to make a living, and those who do make a little surplus above what it costs to live find that the tax collector takes most of that. There is, however, something open to us, a most marvelous offer, that we can become prosperous by going into partnership with God. As those of you who listen to our broadcasts know, God's people Israel of the Bible survive today in the form of the nations we roughly classify as Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Teutonic. From its first establishment as a nation, Israel has been selected by God Himself for a most unusual honor, to work with Him in establishing His kingdom on this earth. Such a partnership has not been offered to any other people. In Leviticus 20, verses 24 to 26, God said, I am Yahweh your God, who have separated you from other people, and ye shall be holy unto me. For I, Yahweh, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine. And in Deuteronomy 7, verse 6, For thou art an holy people unto Yahweh thy God. Yahweh thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto Himself, above all people that are upon the face of the earth. And through the prophet Amos, God said, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. As God's partners, our task was twofold. First, to keep order among the turbulent and warlike nations. And second, to be God's witnesses of the truth of His Word and the excellence of His laws, both at home and by colonizing the world all over the globe. Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. Again, we know that the surviving descendants of the ancient Edomite Jews originated present-day communism, and they are the leaders of communism in all nations today, where they still carry on their ancient hatred of Christianity. In Ezekiel 25, verse 14, God said, "And I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel, and they shall do in Edom according to mine anger and according to my fury, and they shall know my vengeance, saith Yahweh God." This we have never done in all past history, so we know that it is a duty which we must still perform in the future. Today, most people join the thoughtless and the ignorant in denouncing colonialism as a nasty word. But God expressly commanded us to colonize the world. For example, in Genesis 28, verse 14, He said, "Thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east, and to the north and to the south." Again, in Isaiah 54, verses 2 and 3, God said, "Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the nations, and make the desolate cities to be inhabited." When we obeyed these commands, we brought peace and civilization to Africa, India, the Near East, Southeast Asia, Cuba, Indonesia, the Philippines. Now that we have shirked our duty and abandoned these places, are the natives of the Near East and Indonesia as well off as they were under the British and the Dutch? What civilization do Cuba and the Congo have now? And we, in our turn, by this cowardly failure to do our duty, have gained only the hatred of most of the world. Both at home and in other lands we colonized, we were to establish the laws of God, that all the world might see a practical demonstration of the peace and prosperity that would follow. In the 43rd chapter of Isaiah, God said, "But now, thus saith the Lord that created thee, O Jacob, and He that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee, I have called thee by thy name, for thou art mine. Ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me, and understand that I am He. Before me there was no God formed, neither shall there be after me. This people have I formed for myself. They shall show forth my praise." The reward for this was to be very great. Besides the prosperity which would result from living under God's laws, we were to be greatly honored. In Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6, God said, "Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation." The strangest part of this remarkable partnership is the way the profit from it was to be divided. God surely is the senior partner, yet He took only 10% as His share and gave the 90% to us, the junior partners. The rules are given, first in Leviticus 27, verses 30 to 32, that a tithe, that is 10%, of all the increase or income is holy to God. It is His share of the nation's income. Under God's kingdom, this would replace all ordinary taxes. This tithe was paid to the Levites, who made up the entire civil service, not only of the temple, but of all the civil government, and they in turn paid one-tenth of this to the priests. See Numbers 18, verses 24 to 28. Then, for organized charity, there was another tenth every 3 years. So this made up all the taxes paid in God's kingdom, 13 1/3% per year. Fully 1/3 of our entire national income is consumed in these many taxes, 33 1/3% instead of the 13 1/3% we would pay under God's kingdom. No nation in all history has long survived after taxation passed the 30% mark, and we are already well past it, and the politicians' voracious appetite for your money is raising taxes higher and higher. This does not relieve you of your honest duty to give God His 1/10 share as senior partner. This 10% is His money. After all, if you expect him to work for the firm as one of the partners, isn't it right that he should receive his share of the profits? And if he doesn't get it, can you expect him to be a working partner indefinitely? He reminds us of this in Malachi 3, verses 8 to 10. Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring me all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven, and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. When we are able to get back to the kingdom of God, we will be freed of our present crushing burden of most unjust taxation. We will only pay to God His share of the income and have all the rest for ourselves. Think what you could do if you were allowed to keep the income that is rightfully yours, but which your politicians now steal to make your enemies prosperous all over the world. But in the meantime, remember that neither you as an individual nor the nation as a whole can say, I'm in business for myself, this is all mine. You are just a junior member of a partnership whose senior partner is God. As a nation, we have failed to operate the partnership business. We have ceased to police the heathen. We have ceased to colonize and bring education and civilization to the world. And we have stolen the senior partner's share of the profits. You as an individual can still deal honestly and fairly with your senior partner. For he's not only the nation's partner, he is also your partner in your own business. Why don't you take him at his word? Pay God's tithe to support the work of bringing his word to the people, and see what blessings he will give you as his faithful partner.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.